Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your every Monday podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good morning, people.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Thanksgiving Monday.
Well, all right. We're going to talk about reactions to the Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty verdict here in a moment. But first, do you find yourself fatigued trying to keep up with the news, stymied by paywalls, lured in by empty calorie clickbait? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and trashy listicles while showing stories from multiple perspectives in order to counter bias, where you can find actually good news, like positive things that happened, in addition to unearthed nuggets from around the world. All of this and more is available from an innovative Australian startup called Ankle, I-N-K-L. Ankle.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of newsfeed. You can get more than $12,000, that's American dollars, of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount. 25% off, $100, I think that's $25 off. So that's a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just 75 simoleons. Go to inkl.com/podcast today. You'll be glad that you did. Okay. As most of you know, 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse on Friday was found not guilty by a jury of five criminal charges, including three counts of homicide in the 2020 Kenosha, Wisconsin incident when, during the unrest following police shooting of Jacob Blake, Rittenhouse got into a tussle with some demonstrators who had threatened and attacked him. He shot three of them and killed two. Though the not guilty verdict was widely expected by those who had closely followed the presentation of evidence at the trial, that did not stop any number of politicians and journalists and commentators from reacting with outrage and anguish, sometimes including assertions that had long since been debunked. I want to start, Catherine, with the president of these United States, Joseph Robinette Biden III, whose initial reaction Friday was, quote, "Look, I stand by what the jury has concluded. The jury system works, and we have to abide by it." Then, a couple hours later, the White House released a new Biden statement with a somewhat different emphasis, which I shall now read. "While the verdict in Kenosha will leave many Americans feeling angry and concerned, myself included, we must acknowledge that the jury has spoken." So, Catherine, part of the selling proposition of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, if I remember the things correctly, in 2020, was that the adults were going to be back at the table and that we're going to have a restored respect for the norms, with a capital N. How does Biden's second statement in particular square with that particular selling proposition?
You know, there's always almost one Biden that I pretty much like. Like, he's been around for so long and he said all the versions of all the things. And so I actually often find there's like, oh, I'm pleasantly surprised to discover this Biden quote, which reflects a thing I think is appropriate for a person to say or believe. It's just that there's always also another Biden quote, which is like, ah, oh, really? So we got them quite close together this time around. I will say, though, I think your framing is appropriate and relevant here. Let's take a moment to imagine what Donald Trump would have said. And I think it's clear that even the two contrasting statements, the second one, again, I think profoundly unhelpful, they're both still probably better than whatever Donald Trump would have said. And maybe he did say something. Actually, I don't know if he issued a statement from his like weird, like teletype emailed press machine that he has now, but
he has manual Twitter,
carrier pigeon Twitter.
I missed it if he did, but his Biden's first response was right. Absolutely, his first response was right, which was like, the system worked as intended. Stay calm. That was the correct message the first time around.
Nick, as ever, I'm more interested in the politicians that we have as opposed to the ones that are still giving us nightmares. Catherine, the one that we do
have. Although I got to tell you, Martin Van Buren, you know, I think he's just resting, Matt.
I'm all about the Rutherford B. Hayes. Never not Rutherford.
Conundrum. The perfect.
Should we get a poll going? Which politician haunts your nightmares the most? I think that could be. We'll ask Twitter.
You got to rule some out preemptively to make it creative. The aforementioned, and I never know really if it's supposed to be the a or the for that you stress there. So I'd use both. Kamala Harris. She reacted, and this, I think, came in between Biden's two versions. She reacted thusly. The verdict really speaks for itself. I don't think she meant that in a good way. As many of you know, I've spent the majority of my career working to make the criminal justice system more equitable, and clearly there's a lot more to do. End quote. Nick, did you realize that she had been working to make the criminal justice system more equitable?
I just think it's really promising that she managed to evade her handlers, you know, like John Belushi on the weekend before he died. So it's a sign that, you know, she's growing in office. And I suspect that we may get an actual press conference out of her pretty soon.
Whoa.
Before her handlers catch her, you know.
That's so.
You know, to me, that one of the most amazing things about this is how little Joe Biden and Kamala Harris factor into this story or the responses to it. That's not where you see the chatter on Twitter or anywhere else. The president kind of, on a case like this, has to weigh in. I don't actually find his two statements particularly, worthy of note. He's going to have to say something. He says something basically anodyne and kind of stupid in both cases. And, you know, this isn't where things are going on. What is, to me, is the real takeaway from the Rittenhouse stuff is whether or not the media, the mainstream media, you know, the legacy media or whatever, do they take any lessons from this other than that they are always right, even when they are absolutely wrong? And there has been a number of people, including, you know, kind of leftist critics of the left or people on the left who criticize the left, like a Jesse Singel, somebody like a Barry Weiss, have written devastating exposés of how bad the coverage coming out of Kenosha was last summer. Nellie Bowles, who's married to Barry, was at the New York Times, may still be there. I don't know. Also wrote, a phenomenal piece about this. And, that's to me where the focus should be, because you have the regular, you know, attaboys on the right and the left who are saying, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse for president, you know, let's waive the Constitution and let's vote him in. He's such a go-getter. Or this shows, I mean, some of the dumbest takes were that somehow Kyle Rittenhouse, who's white, shooting and killing two and wounding another white guy, that this is all about white supremacy and keeping the black man down. It's not any of those things. But really what I would like to see is somebody responsible in, you know, at the New York Times, the Washington Post, major media coming forward and saying this is how we fucked this story up, because they really did.
I would argue that the comment from the president of the United States about a jury trial that in which he is seeming to kind of bow to the prejudices of his own party is worthy of note, when it's in, especially when it's inappropriate. That goes president of any stripe in any direction. And it leads to the increasing notion in a hyper-polarized world that everything is results-based and not process-based. If we don't get the result that we like, we hate it and play to the prejudice of that rather than point to the due process, which is something that the executive of the law, I think, should be the most sensitive about. Of just about anybody, Peter. Build on Nick's
Matt,
media point.
You have a phrase that you've coined to talk about that, or to talk about the outcome of this. Something about epistemic scissoring.
That's not
which is not as sexy as it sounds. To be quite honest,
it's not my phrase. I don't think that. I think you're. Brilliantly putting together two different ones that are both worthy of note, which is Scott Alexander, the Slate Star Codex guy, wrote about it in 2018, talking about a scissoring effect. And again, keep your minds out of the gutter. At which big controversial items, notions in the news are treated in two separate ways, in ways that are not matched up with one another. An example would be the Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process and rape allegations, in which you really felt like when you're watching people process this, that two different worlds who do not much intersect except in the body of Jesse Singel are like just describing worlds.
I thought you said to keep our minds out of the gutter.
That is true. So to put this in the form of a question, Peter, is the... given that, you know, that Twitter, for example, was banning people or at least suspending accounts last summer for people who would just opine that Kyle Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense, which kind of is what the jury concluded, or at least it seems that they concluded in that. And as Nick rightly points out, you just had news organizations saying that Jacob Blake was killed, which he wasn't, you know, that journalists on CNN up the wazoo were saying that Kyle Rittenhouse's mother drove him across state lines into a riot armed. None of that is true. Is there an epistemic closure to get the Julian Sanchez phrase problem in the media right now?
Well, I think we should start with a disclosure, which is that we're recording this podcast across state lines. So, you know, there's a lot of information packets.
I do not comply.
Yeah.
I do not consent.
Being transferred between the District of Columbia and the State of New York right now. And probably someone at the ACLU should look into that. No, I think this is a real issue. But I'm also not quite sure that it is a new one, because it's always been the case that people on the left and people on the right, and in particular hardcore partisans, consume different news sources. There just aren't a whole lot of people outside of the realm of professional opinion journalists who, for example, subscribe to both National Review and The Nation. And that's been true for as long as both of those publications have been around. It feels different in the social media era, and in some ways, it is different, right? The mechanisms are different, and people are exposed to this stuff in a way that feels, that certainly feels more intense, and maybe even arguably is more intense, just because we have access to such a much higher volume of information and opinion coming out sort of all the time, right? Like, there's no more. I'm just barely old enough to remember. For real. Yes, that phrase actually is appropriate here. I'm just barely old enough to remember when the 24-hour news cycle was actually 24 hours and news would break at regular timed intervals that were basically scheduled in the morning, maybe a little bit in the afternoon, but then again in the early evening news and then for the late night news. And this was, there was sort of a rhythm to it rather than this just sort of all day deluge. And so, again, it feels different now. But the fact that people are consuming media that meets their partisan expectations, that meets their ideological expectations, I think is just a fact about people in a world where people can choose what they want to consume. And it's more transparent. It's maybe a little louder. It's maybe a little more rowdy than it was 30 or 40 years ago, at least in the information age. But I'm not sure it's actually all that different in character.
I think it's a little different. I don't know. I mean, I agree with everything you just said and feel like I am appropriately jaded. And yet the levels of kind of purposeful ignorance, what seemed like purposeful ignorance with the Rittenhouse thing in particular, seemed higher to me than usual. And there are a bunch of reasons why that might be true. But like just the, as Matt quoted, the variety of like basic factual inaccuracies that came out from institutions and powerful people who have whole staffs to help them get this sort of thing right. And also to get back to something we were talking about earlier, what seemed to be a level of, if not purposeful ignorance, then sort of inexcusable ignorance about what was normal in the process. So like this whole kerfuffle about whether or not you could call the people who were shot victims during the trial, which is a totally normal thing. This is like a thing that happens in courtrooms on the regular, is like you have to negotiate some of these terms. And that is done through a standard procedure, which everyone agrees on. Lots of people who can or should have known better acting like somehow this was like the ghost of Donald Trump acting through the body of this judge in order to further white supremacy, which was just not what was happening. So I think that the very high level of high speed, ill-informed chatter on this case in particular was striking to me. Again, not that this is the first time any of this has happened. And I think there is a legitimate question here of like, do I perceive that because I am so very online? And what happened in the real world? I don't know. I have no access to the real world anymore.
Let me just ask really quick. If you guys think this is different, is it different than the media panics that were just based on wildly false information that we saw in the 1970s and 80s? You know, stuff like the Satanic Panic, where we just sort of major media outlets adopted the notion that a group of psychologists who had found recovered memories, right? Like, you know, who had gotten information out of kids through like bizarre manipulative practices. Oh no, this is just normal psychology. This is how it's done, right? Like, it just sort of seems to me that there's always been motivated bad information in major media outlets about big stories that people are really riled up about. And that's not to say that it's good or that we should ignore it. And that's not to say that anything that happened here in terms of the bad and inaccurate media coverage was acceptable or that we shouldn't, you know, sort of expect better. At the same time, I'm not sure that it is an entirely new phenomenon, and I'm not sure that it's even, that the degree of it is even all that different. It just sort of seems like the mechanisms are new.
So I think the difference is that there are more people, and those people often have more power, who are acting like the media, right? Like, this is what Matt was saying. Like, the problem isn't that the media got the story wrong. The media always gets the story wrong, including even us, the media, sometimes. But Joe Biden being a pundit in that mode of getting the story a little wrong, and then, in fact, doing a second take, right? Like, I mean, it's like he did two different shows and had different takes on the different shows. And, you know, the ACLU being a pundit on this case rather than being an institutional player that should be a bulwark against some of these things. Like, that to me is a thing that is not unique to this case, but it is increasingly happening and accelerating in a way
that
this
is troubling. Just part of a world in which the definition of journalist, of pundit, of is shifting, and in which access to the ability to publish to mass audiences easily has been granted to nearly everyone. Right? I mean, it's not just the ACLU; it's also every lefty, righty, right, every person who has access to a phone can download Twitter and can build a following, or not even build a following, but catch the eye of someone who has a following and instantly be in the feeds of hundreds of thousands or even millions of people. And that, I suppose, is different. At the same time, the democratization of media is something we've also championed.
I think it's a good thing. And I think one of the biggest differences is that what has changed is you have counter narratives now that become as powerful. The difference between this and the Satanic panics, mostly in the 80s, particularly in the McMartin preschool trial and whatnot, there was no counter narrative that was available. So in a purely structural way, at least we had two sides, you know, on this story. We had a kind of fisking of the Rittenhouse trial or the claims that had been made. Whereas in the past, that didn't happen until after the legacy media got around to, if they ever do, to admitting what they got wrong and then doing these long after, kind of mea culpas or mostly pointing fingers at other media sources that got it wrong. So I think that's different, and I think it's democratized. I think it's good. I want to focus, though, on the media here because that's what's different. At the same time, you know, there's the Ahmaud Arbery trial that's still going on, which is also a case where people are claiming self-defense. You know, people who shot an unarmed black guy who was running through their neighborhood in Augusta, Georgia. The media showed very little interest in kind of the larger issue of self-defense. There's an even more amazing story that came out of Vero Beach, Florida in 2017. A guy named Andrew Coffey IV shot at police after they started a no-knock raid in his in his apartment. His girlfriend was killed in the crossfire by police, who then charged Coffey with murder. He got charged with murder on this. He was acquitted this weekend, or, you know, just right around the time that that Rittenhouse was. He was acquitted of murder charges, and he's black, and he was acquitted of, you know, shooting at white officers. Like, where the hell is the media that you, I mean, this shows a sickness and a groupthink, if not an ideological conformity among most media. That is, like, they're leaving freaking great stories on the table, or moments where, like, okay, this is a moment to talk about what constitutes self-defense in an America that has more guns and less crime than ever, pretty much.
Catherine, you referenced the ACLU, which is, that stands for the American Civil Liberties Union.
Not anymore.
Earlier. Well, let's talk about that. Their response, the ACLU Wisconsin, was right out of the gate, like minutes, seconds after the verdict, talking about how this verdict shows the deep roots of white supremacy that kept Rittenhouse from being held responsible for his actions. And then they also emphasized Rittenhouse's conscious decision to travel across state lines and injure one person and take the lives of two people who were protesting. It's a conscious decision. He woke up and did that, apparently, says the American Civil Liberties Union. One, I would like you just to sort of bask in that a little bit, or explain why the not anymore comment from you. And then I got a little follow up. But let's start with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this has been going on for a long time, that the ACLU, perhaps like many of the kind of great institutions of the left up to and including the Democratic Party, is right now torn between a historical old style centrist liberalism and a progressivism that sees many, if not all, issues through the lens of demographic identity. And that's what's on display here. Like, they absolutely could have chosen to coin a phrase, stay in their lane, and talk about whether or not Rittenhouse's civil liberties were respected, and if not, to act to make sure that other people's civil liberties are respected. That is not what they did. They were talking about something else entirely. And, you know, I would say not an appropriate thing for their mission, but their mission is changing. And it may be that this is an institution that no longer serves the role that it once did. Side note, I get that people, in a strictly legal context, like, the crossing of state lines is often highly relevant. It establishes that this is, you know, the business of the federal government in many cases. But people are saying that phrase like they think they're doing something. And I don't quite understand why every dummy on this entire planet is like, well, he crossed state lines. Like, it's not illegal to cross state lines. It shouldn't be illegal to cross state lines with your private property, but he certainly, you know.
No, and he also,
he didn't.
His father lived in Kenosha. He had a job in Kenosha. Right. He stayed in Kenosha,
like,
et cetera.
This is a country, like, of 50
he's
states.
He's near the Wisconsin border.
We have a habit of crossing state lines here. Yeah. It's like, I don't think it means what you think it means.
Peter, just to put you on the spot about race, because I think that's why you wake up in the morning.
We all love that
on
when
Mondays.
You do that, so, yeah.
But maybe this kind of points to, here's a hypothesis, let's say, that might point to a explanation for Nick's pointing out of disparities in interest by the media in a variety of different criminal justice stories, that, and also kind of points to, like, what's different now. Maybe what's different now, and would like to see what you think about this, is that there has been the development and the adoption among organizations, including the ACLU, of an overarching narrative about race in this country, that that there's a basic thing having to do with white supremacy or people who are unhappy with demographic changes in this country. And the stories that would seem to play that up are the ones that get the most attention, and the ones that don't. What is your assessment of my hypothesis?
Well, there's absolutely a narrative on the left that says that we shouldn't treat people as individuals. Instead, we should treat them as member of demographic groups and rate and rank them by their historic cultural and political power. And that then we should view everything through that lens. And I think you can see that narrative and that idea very clearly in the ACLU's response to the Rittenhouse case, in the response of other organizations, which is that the ACLU is supposedly a civil liberties organization, right? And the whole thing about civil liberties is that they apply to everyone absolutely equally as individuals, right? It doesn't take into account your demographic, economic, cultural, political power status at all. Civil liberties are designed to say you're a person, you're an individual, that's it. So you get these. But that's not how the kind of modern progressive movement wants political power, legal power, economic power to be understood, and that's not how they want it to work in the United States. They want it to always be run through this kind of power calculator, right? Where if someone is part of a group that has had political power in the United States or currently has political power, then that person needs to be judged differently than someone who, say, is part of a group that doesn't have political power or has not historically had political power. And so I think in some sense, the ACLU is making it clear that they are no longer in a meaningful way an organization devoted to the classic idea of civil liberties. And I kind of wonder if there's going to be a rebranding here. And it actually makes me think of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, right? And so you guys remember Kentucky Fried Chicken used to be called Kentucky Fried Chicken. And then they were like, man, that whole thing, the two words fried chicken, they have bad connotations because people think fried chicken makes you fat. And so they just changed their name to KFC, and they were like, it doesn't mean anything. It's just three letters.
But do
just
you remember?
Three letters, and they may have changed it back. I don't know.
No, but do you remember, like, one of the weird side effects of that was that a conspiracy theory was born that maybe it had never been chicken.
Ooh.
That, like, this was actually their way of not doing, you know, getting caught in false advertising. And I wonder, in the case of the ACLU, if they did that, if there would then be a conspiracy theory, which was like they never had civil liberties in there in the first place.
Do you think the ACLU is going to come up with a retrofit acronym like the way Arby's claimed to stand for America's Roast Beef, Yes, Sir, in an ad campaign for Boston?
Did you just say a real thing?
ACLU is going to come up with, like,
you know? I mean,
yeah, that's
I,
a real thing.
I think
come
everything.
No, you know, I realize you coastal elitists only go to Shakespeare operas, you know, at the Louvre.
I thought you were going to say
Shake Shack. But the rest of us who live in the real America, Shake Shack is not fast food. It's good food quickly.
Absolutely an evening that I would have.
100%. I mean, I think, you know, everything Peter said is right about, you know, how we should think about civil liberties. There is, of course,
And
Kentucky Fried Chicken. There is, of course, a very important asterisk on it, which is that historically, we as a nation have done a fairly garbage job of, in fact, equally delivering civil liberties across all demographic groups, right?
Yes, and the modern progressive argument is that because we've done such a bad job of it historically, we should give up on that project entirely. And that's absolutely the wrong way to think about it.
This is also the ACLU has never, I can recall reading not the title of a Jacob Sullum story in Reason from the early 90s, which was about how the ACLU had never taken gun rights seriously. And so in this particular case, you know, built around self-defense and, you know, and a shooting incident, I wouldn't expect the ACLU to be any good, whatever. Obviously, there's the documentary about Ira Glasser, the longtime ACLU head who retired in 99 or whatever, Mighty Ira, who raises exactly this question that the ACLU is really no longer interested in its focus on speech rights and free expression and free assembly. And I think that's true. And I think they'll suffer as a result of that. But also, if we're talking about, you know, issues of white supremacy and whatnot, remember the incident that is lurking behind all of this, which is the George Floyd case. You know, not even although the Rittenhouse riot or the riots that Rittenhouse went to were after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. You know, with Floyd, all of the coverage of that trafficked in, you know, classic kind of like cocaine drug crazed Negro tropes as well. So, I mean, when we talk about American civil criminal justice and civil liberties, we're always in a disgusting, you know, kind of stew pot of, you know, of racial animus and overlays that, again, I wish that the media would actually spend some time working through this rather than really just glomming on. I think that the big takeaway for me, going back to Peter's original point, is that there was such a real-time debunking of many of the claims that were being made in the mainstream media as well as on the partisan left. That's the difference, and that's kind of a takeaway. And it might also lead to more polarization and epistemic scissoring of the non-Pornhub variety.
I just would finally add a thing that people maybe didn't forget, but haven't, I don't think, spent enough time processing, which was that in the George Floyd case, Derek Chauvin, the white cop whose actions killed a black man, race was not a factor in the trial. It just wasn't brought up as a motivation, even though that was the context that a lot of people, the majority of the country, sort of was reacting to. And also the white cop got convicted, which does not happen as a matter of course. It's possible to look at some of these outcomes and maybe come to different conclusions than the ones that are the most widespread. All right, we're going to pause for a moment and get to our email of the week in a second. But first, as listeners of the Reason Roundtable know all too well, the thing that we call health insurance does not, in fact, always pay for the full amount of medical bills during an emergency, especially for transportation. Even with comprehensive coverage, so-called, you can still get hit with super high deductibles and copays. That is where the AirMed Care Network steps in. When you join AirMed Care as a member, if an emergency arises requiring transportation by air, you will not see a bill when flown by an AMCN provider. And you can have that peace of mind for your entire household, beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. AMCN providers transport more than 100,000 patients a year. As a listener to this very show, you can get, along with your new membership, a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card, which basically makes the whole thing nearly free, at least for the first year. This is the kind of coverage that no family should be without. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON. You can remember that, right? Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Keep emailing your normal weekly questions to roundtable@reason.com. And also, please keep sending to that same address special webathon questions that we will be processing, reacting to, hiding from in plain sight next week during our annual bonus video webcast, whatever podcast thingy, during our annual fundraising drive that we do here called the Webathon. Remember also that those webathon questions can be targeted to individual roundtableists, especially if they're named Nick. Okay, this week's comes from Avi from Canada, who writes, how much stock do you put in the international rankings of freedom in the world put out by places like Cato, Fraser Institute, Freedom House, The Economist, WSJ, Heritage, etc.? Such indices generally have the USA in the top 25, but not top 10 in the world. Is that a correct assessment, or is it possible that America is still the home of freedom and that these indices are missing something? Catherine?
So I actually have, I have asked myself this question from time to time, because on the one hand, if you go digging around in the guts of any of these lists, you will almost certainly find something to disagree with in terms of how they are setting their priorities and how they are evaluating what it means to be free. Nobody's hiding the ball here, but, you know, you do have to make choices. What's more important, the, you know, percentage of the population that's in prison or the capital gains rate, right? I mean, you just have to choose which of those things is more important in your freedom ranking, and any consumer of these rankings will always disagree with some of those choices. But then more broadly, I think I come down in favor of the existence of these rankings. And while I wouldn't put stock in them in the sense of, I don't know, moving to the top ranked country because I want to be free, I do think they have an incredible value, which is that people want to win. People are just always trying to win the future. They're trying to beat China. They want to win the trade war. They want to be the best.
I want to win the morning.
Sometimes you just need to win the morning, whatever it is. And so if we can harness...
So are you channeling Charlie Sheen or Donald Trump right now?
Both. That's what I'm saying. We can harness that energy, which is a big energy, toward maximizing freedom, then good. Care about these rankings. Try to win at them. That will generally be a force for good. If people with power pay attention to these at all, I think that will generally result in better policy, better impulses, checks on authoritarianism. And so I am therefore in favor of them. I'm instrumentally in favor of them.
I just want to point out, I looked up the most recent Fraser Institute rankings, as well as the Heritage Foundation's. And Matt, you'll enjoy this. Heritage Foundation had France being 1 degree less economically free than Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is ranked 63rd. France is 64th.
Oh, yeah.
In Fraser, which tends to rank countries more in terms of quartiles, France is in the second quartile, but it's 53 to Saudi Arabia's 91, which gives you a sense of these things seem to be mapping or covering very different things. And while I like the Fraser Institutes more, the U.S. there is ranked number 6th, whereas it's 20th in the Heritage. And I think the Fraser Institutes is better. They also do state-by-state rankings in the United States. And this is where there's real limits to all of this stuff, because they always put Kansas. The state of Kansas is always one of the most economically free countries. And states, and if the, and then places like California and New York are always among the very least. But, you know, on a certain level, we get a sense of how much people actually value economic freedom. If Kansas is in fact the free, you know, one of the very freest states in the country, and nobody wants to live there, relatively speaking, it's a rounding error in the population of America. And then hellholes like New York. New York City, you know, the largest city by more than, you know, 100, you know, it's twice as big as the next largest city, is an absolute gulag economic freedom wise. And yet, you know, there you have it.
But losing population. Suderman, do you have a favorite among these, or do you like to roll around?
No,
these numbers?
Literally the opposite. I don't have a favorite. I like, instead, my favorite thing about these is that there are a bunch of them. And that's why I think they are useful. And useful does not mean perfect or necessarily even right at all. But what I like is that there are a whole lot of these indices, and they're all, like, they're transparent about their methodology, and they all come to different results. And what that points to is that there are different conceptions of freedom, and in particular of legal freedom. And so you have all of these things, and they are competing with each other, which is great. Competition is wonderful. And then that gives you, the consumer of freedom indices, the freedom to decide for yourself.
I do think, like college football, though, there should be a playoff system.
That's
economic indices.
That's an excellent point. I would just add the possibility of that. You can look at, regardless of how you end up measuring it, every single country has at least one absolutely anti-freedom kink, like, that dominates the other, like, ones.
Epistemic schism.
And I would say in our case,
what do you think Germany says, Matt?
Don't even start with
since
me.
You're talking about kinks don't and
even,
all that.
I once was a pals with a French porn star who wouldn't do work in Germany because those people were too perverted. says it all. All right, let's switch topics and get our minds out of the gutter.
I mean,
here.
They are into bratwurst.
Really? That's where we went with that?
You are just not.
Oh, that is so bad. Can we take that back, Peter?
We'll just we'll bleep it out. Let people let their imagination run wild.
Think it was funny.
Fancy sausage. Yeah.
No, the K on Friday, speaking of sausage, the House of Representatives passed in a party line vote. Thank
yes.
you very much.
Yes.
President Joe Biden's Build Back Better bill, triple B, B cubed, which is the third and possibly final and possibly never to be signed into law piece of his big domestic agenda in year one. This one clocks in at $1.75 trillion. Legislation will be changed in the Senate over the coming months. They're talking about maybe a vote before Christmas. Who knows? Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin obviously will be writing it in their own blood and such. It would then need to get passed again in the House. So all of this is preliminary, but it's still a bill that got passed, a huge one, $1.75 trillion on top of the combined, depending on how you measure it, $3 trillion from the infrastructure bill and the last coronavirus bailout, whatever the hell, that passed earlier.
The American Recovery Plan.
Thank you. Just recovering.
ARP.
Right,
America's
left.
Roast beef. Yes, sir.
And also there's a gigantic defense increase, which the Bernie Sanders and Ro Khanna types are saying, like, hey, why isn't that getting any coverage? Why are people so outraged by this new one? They should have been outraged by the old one. We here at Reason are outraged by all of them. We have talked on this roundtable several times about the micro elements of the Build Back Better agenda. So I just want to talk real briefly about the macro thing and what it says about Democratic priorities, government making in 2021, and so forth. Catherine, is the Democratic Party the party of big government?
Such a Matt Welsh situation there.
Listen, I'm just trying to help
you.
Yeah,
dude. I mean, both the parties are the party of big government, but Democrats are really doing their level best to, like, hold on to that title, even in an era of everybody liking big government. And we talked about this a little in past discussions of this bill, that the extent to which the fight about this bill is just a fight about its size. It is just like a battle to the death to get it to be as big as possible while still theoretically having a chance to pass. And that is not the right way to do this. That's not the way. I think ideally we would have done these several major pieces of legislation that are contained within this bill as separate pieces of legislation, debated and passed on their own. But it also just strikes me as the economy continues to do well, except for the looming inflation and labor problems, like, it is not. That is sort of a true thing, though, right? But, like, the correct move at this point is not to
but
dump.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like
I
the
walked
play,
by
right?
Ford's Theater this weekend, and it's looking a little down at the heels. But, the fact that there is this, the pre-existing economic conditions now, as they are getting up to potentially actually passing this bill, which are very different than the ones in many ways that were in place when they first started talking about this and dumping a huge amount of borrowed money, essentially. I know that's highly debated, but borrowed money essentially into this current system does not strike me as the way to help Americans. And yet, at this point, big bill or die. And so that's what we're doing.
Well, and the bill is actually much bigger than the headline numbers here, right? So Matt said $1.75 trillion. There are also estimates that put the gross cost over $2 trillion. And then if you look at all of the provisions that are designed to, that are written into the legislation as expiring, but are designed to not expire, right? So this is a budget gimmick that Democrats used. It's been used by Republicans in different ways before. Democrats have also used it. So this is, in some ways, isn't something new, although typically it's not done for a slew of mega programs at this scale. And I think the scale of it is new here. But if you actually look at all of the programs that are fake, that are written into the legislation as designed to expire, but then actually intended to never expire, the true total cost of this is more like $5 trillion. It's about $4.5 to $4.9 trillion, according to estimates from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which I just got to say,
is that a lot
folks,
of money?
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And I got to say, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget has just been absolutely essential for understanding this bill and for seeing, like, all of the budget gimmicks and all of the costs here. And they have a great breakdown that's just like a huge amount of this bill. It has been written in a way that is in some ways it's both intentionally deceptive and not, because they're explaining that they are being deceptive even while they're doing it. It's a little like a Penn and Teller trick, right? It's like, here, we're going to write this, and it's only going to last this. We're going to say that in the legislation, this program is only going to last for 1 or 2 years. And then the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which produces the official scores, will only produce 1 or 2 years worth of score for, they will estimate only 1 or 2 years worth of cost for it. But Democrats are saying, we intend this program to last forever, and therefore there are actually many more years' worth of costs that are not scored as part of this. And so if you add it all up, it's actually much, much bigger than it looks on paper and that the headline numbers look. And also all of those further years of intended program that are not actually written into the legislation, all of those years are not yet paid for. because of course they didn't raise taxes or shift around spending at all to pay for the money that they are not technically spending within this bill, but that they expect to spend and that they plan to spend after passing this.
Nick, if you can react to this, Joseph Biden, Robinette Biden III, he has said that, quote, 17 Nobel Prize winners in economics have said that my plan will ease inflationary pressures. Is he right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, they were all Nobel Prize winners in literature. But they did say that. Yeah. And it's interesting because a couple days later, some people in the press went back and said to them, what do you mean? Because they all signed on to a thing that said in the long run or in the long term. And as Keynes reminds us, in the long run, we're all dead. So and a bunch of them were like, oh, in the short term, it's going to increase inflation, which is absolutely clearly it's going to do. Well, because we have been jacking.
And they also signed it at a time when the administration was claiming that the whole thing was going to be paid for by higher taxes, right?
Right.
I mean, which I think is important, yeah. Right? Like,
or by other fuddy-duddy right. things. But it doesn't
even matter. Remember, the total winners. Cost of this bill is yeah. zero.
Zero. It's
we heard
zero.
That from the yeah. White House so yeah. many times.
Look, there is no reason to believe that Nobel Prize winners should be guiding public policy for
Except
the most
for
part.
Bob Dylan.
Especially when we're talking about macroeconomics. Exactly. And Bob Dylan has been the leader, the spiritual leader of America for at least 50, 60 years now. But when you look at the amount of money that has been dumped into the economy so quickly, it's really mind-boggling. And if you take 2018 and 2019, we spent about $9.6 trillion over the course of two federal budgets. In the most recent year, we've come closer to like $14 trillion, $15. I mean, it's been the 2 years before, 2018 and 2019. In the past 2 years, we've increased federal outlays by 56%. With absolutely no increase in kind of productive capacity or anything like that. At the same time, the Fed balance sheet, and the Fed basically bought all the bonds that the government used to borrow money on, the Fed balance sheet doubled, more than doubled from $4 trillion to $8.6 trillion. And I've seen numbers, I don't know exactly if this is accurate, but something like 40, 45% of all dollars in circulation have been created in the past year or 18 months. Like, we have thrown so much money into an economy, there can only be inflation in the short term and in the midterm. And everybody agrees with this. People like Tyler Cowen, who is trying to be kind of loosey-goosey or in the middle about this, says like, in the long run, it's going to be fine. But, you know, the next two or three years, it's going to be bad. And there's a possibility that when the time comes for the Fed to tighten the money supply or the government to stop spending, they're probably not going to do it if the past 20 years is any indication, or with the exception of the way that the economy, the Fed functioned in the 80s, the Fed doesn't like to do that. So, inflation is here. Inflation is here as a function of government and Fed created money, and it's not going to go away. And I think with Build Back Better, one of the ways to think about this, if only to fight it, as much as possible, is that it really is kind of the last piece in Biden's first flurry of attempts to really kick up the level of government in everyday life and lock it down for a while. In this, he's building on Obama, he's building on Bush, he's building on Trump. And this is a big deal because it's not going to come back down after this. It might not continue to increase at the same rate, but it's a real problem. And it represents another click on the wheel. What's the atomic clock, is looking at nuclear Armageddon or whatever, the end of the planet. This is like on the clock of big government getting to a point where it is just totally massively dominant in every aspect of everyday life. This is a major, major attempt here.
But Catherine, your friend Cory Doctorow told me that giant companies are hiking prices because they know that they have a monopoly and because they know that their customers will accept higher prices because everyone knows we have an inflation problem. Isn't that the explanation?
Yeah. I mean, that actually, Elizabeth Warren also made a similar argument this morning or yesterday, that this is sort of big companies are being opportunistic about the, I don't know where it was supposed to have come from, you know, fake inflation panic or something, and they're using this to increase prices. This is not the right way to think about what's going on. And, you know, it is true that there is a kind of self-perpetuating cycle here. People who believe inflation is coming do things to prepare for that, which include, you know, raising prices and also which include raising interest rates, private interest rates. And so there will be, we will see individuals in a large and complicated economic system making decisions that I suppose if you just want to isolate that one thing, the oil billionaires in Elizabeth Warren's case, and blame them for it, you can, but you would be wrong. You would be misunderstanding how the broader system works in this case. And, you know, the biggest and most alarming piece of this to me is what happens when, A, the dollar weakens relative to other currencies, because right now U.S. inflation is outpacing Eurozone and G20 inflation, I believe. And also, you know, we have a lot of debt. And when we have to pay that back with a higher interest rate, that is going to be a big problem. A big problem. Like a big one.
Super,
super big problem. And that will accelerate the deadline. That will bring forward the deadline of the moment when we cannot afford to do all the things that the federal government is doing.
So we really need to maximize the contradictions and amenitize
the
eschaton. This
is, this is one of my great themes is like, it never gets bad enough that everyone wakes up one morning a libertarian and then it all gets better. That is not, unfortunately, how our politics work.
Let's find out. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere or just drinking like a common loon in the Reason office. Peter, why don't you go first?
So I have been drinking beer, which is delicious. It is a beer called Obscenity, and it is named in honor of the comic Lenny Bruce. And so I was able to have an early...
Oh, shouldn't it, if it's named after Lenny Bruce, shouldn't it have been called Unfunny? Oh,
yeah. Nick, come on.
Could have mailed that one
too
in.
Too soon.
This is
too soon.
It should have been called Delicious. I don't know if Lenny Bruce was delicious. No, but the beer is great. It's a Flying Dog beer. It's an Imperial IPA, unfiltered, about 8.7% IPA, ABV. So it's a pretty big beer, but it doesn't feel overpowered or too alcoholic. And it's really sort of just sort of caramely and rich and super interesting. This is my favorite style of beer, is the very rich but not wildly over bitter IPA. Comes in a tall boy, and the packaging has Lenny Bruce's mugshot from when he was arrested, as well as an essay. This is a beer can with an essay about free speech on it, written by Robert Korn Revere, who was also at this event that I attended. He's got a new book out titled The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder. He is a great free speech lawyer who in fact convinced the state of New York to give comic Lenny Bruce a posthumous pardon. And so this was a great event for a great beer. Really enjoyed it. This is a limited release. So if you see this stuff in stores, I don't know how widely it's being distributed. But if you see this stuff, it's absolutely worth picking up if you like IPAs at all. And you should. If you don't, why do you not like IPAs?
Peter at this event, and it was hosted, of course, by Jim Caruso, who is a Reason trustee. He was kind enough to invite us. This was the debut of this beer. So I think we were the first people outside of Flying Dog to taste it. We also got to see the brewery. But I want to just highlight one detail, which is that it is an unfiltered version of Flying Dog's, one of its most popular beers, which is called The Truth. So Obscenity is unfiltered truth is what happened there.
Yeah,
and it's
wonderful.
Great.
Wow. Wow. Catherine, do you want to talk about other things that you consumed, or is this going to be your category?
No, I'll talk about something else. After I slept in because of how many of those delicious beers I drank, I then went to the African-American History Museum, which I had not been to, which makes me a bad, nice white person in DC. Like, I really was behind on my like minimum standard of, you know, racially balanced cultural consumption or something. And so my husband and I shared an e-scooter. We scooted on one together, which was adorable and very fun, over to the museum. And it's just a really, really good museum. It is, unfortunately, the vibe is much more Holocaust museum than anything else. Like, that's the closest comparison, you know, for good reasons. When you arrive, they send you down to the basement to do three levels of history, and then you kind of emerge up into the light, and you can then look at the kind of cultural and historical sort of successes of the Black community in the United States. The one tidbit I want to point out that's great about this museum is, you know, lots of sponsorship money obviously flowed in to this museum, which has been in the works for a long time. But the naming rights for the galleries are like almost comically on point. So like Northrop Grumman sponsors the exhibit about all the Black Americans who died in wars, and Nike sponsors the sports gallery. Oprah sponsors the theater, and Bill Gates sponsored the big, dumb, expensive, resource hogging like lobby thing that there's no point of it. So it just was like very perfect.
Yeah. He didn't do the Tuskegee syphilis experiment.
You know, he certainly did not do it himself. No.
Is an incredible the subtext museum. Here that billionaires are good?
The subtext here is billionaires are good. Thank you for making my subtext into
contractors.
Text. You're not wrong. And also that it's just a really excellent museum, and that I recommend it to anyone who happens to be passing through Washington, D.C.
Right there in the Smithsonian, not in the Smithsonian, on the National Mall.
So right,
right
on the National Mall. It's right in the shadow of the Washington Monument. It's a, I guess not in the shadow of the Washington Monument because that's a very skinny shadow. But it's a little bit difficult to get tickets. We actually walked up though and got in. I guess I suggest that also as a hack, like going in the late afternoon and just saying, hey, is there any chance we can see this museum? Seems to have worked in this case.
It's going to take a while to scrub the image of you and your husband on an e-scooter.
It was so fun.
Just smiling and saying,
hui,
waving to the suaves. Hi, suaves, yeah. As you're going by. Nick, cleanse our palate with some wholesome entertainment that you consume.
Nothing is more wholesome than what I just gave you, Matt. My God.
I went to see Flying Over Sunset, which is a play that is a fictional depiction of of Claire Booth Luce, the ambassador, congresswoman, and playwright, Aldous Huxley, the novelist, and psychedelic bon vivant, and Cary Grant, well known for taking LSD over 100 times under a doctor's supervision. It's a musical based on these three people intersecting and talking and taking LSD together at Lincoln Center. The two things I'll report about it. One is that the play was not that great, but the fact of it is just stunning. I did take some LSD. I took what is called a mini dose in order to get through it. So I took about a 50 mic dose of LSD. Yeah. Looking back on it, I wish I had taken maybe like a heroic dose of 300 mics. But it's a great idea. The stagecraft is interesting, but it's insane on a glorious way, you know, of like, it's a real Broadway-type show tune musical. It was supposed to be here a year or so ago, but the pandemic shut it down. It came out of California. But it's just like a conventional Broadway musical. And like, is there anything less psychedelic, you know, than a Broadway musical score? And it is, you know, it just seems, it's very strange, but it's kind of wonderful. And I recommend people going, especially if you want to feel young, because I am 58 years old, and this was at Lincoln Center, which is built upon the remains of my father's old neighborhood, where he was born in the 20s, in a part of what was then an Irish ghetto. Nobody came out and said, you know, we apologize for, you know, this play is being staged on the hollow grounds of, you know, Irish tenements. But I was at 58. I was probably 20 years younger than the average other people who were there. And I want to know, what were they thinking? Like, because they must have been like, that Cary Grant, Claire Booth Luce, is she still alive? Or, well, you know, I just saw the women last week. And so it was a very strange and kind of wonderful event. And again, I've written a lot about how the psychedelic renaissance is upon us. I mean, it's glorious. And this is just one more, you know, kind of love bead on that string.
Also on the hallowed grounds, Lincoln Center. Oh, no, I'm thinking the Kennedy Center. Sorry, I'm screwing that up. I'm just going to retract everything I just said.
Just finish it, Matt.
No, not going to. That's a time for another story about German-American history. Just leave it at that. So it's, since we're all absolutely staying in character for our recommendations, I listened to the new record, came out last week, of Brian Wilson. I did that. Called At My...
Is he doing grains? He's past vegetables. Let's do grains now.
It's called At My Piano, and it's just what it sounds like. Brian Wilson playing a piano of a lot of his beloved, he's the Beach Boys, main brother, and the only
studio genius,
only surviving brother. Actually, it's really interesting to hear those songs played stripped of their two most notable sonic elements, which are their beautiful vocal harmonies and all the studio mastery, not just Brian Wilson, but other players. He had the Wrecking Crew, the best backup studio band, arguably, or one of the two or three in musical pop music history. That's all gone. It's just a dude at a piano and no singing. And it really strikes you the kind of hidden complication of a lot of songs that sound simple upon listening to it, because you're just listening to the usual harmonies and production of it. But songs like not just God Only Knows, but even In My Room and other things like that, the complexity.
Student Demonstration Time? Does he do Student Demonstration
Time? Just oddly
time
left off, but I don't think that was actually a Brian Wilson composition.
Would you say this is his Mingus Plays Piano?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I don't know.
What about Never Learn Not to Love? Does that one come up?
Nope. The Manson catalog was unmined.
Could you describe the speaker system thing that you listened to this on?
I hate you all.
For Catherine's benefit.
It was my laptop, Peter. Although I did use the Alexa machine upstairs as well on this, and I don't mean Catherine's daughter.
Are you sure you even really heard it at all?
Is it any good?
You know what? I'm going to record a solo podcast, like addendum at the end of this, where I can describe this and you guys can just ask questions into the void. No, I enjoyed it very much, found it very moving. The one song that was noticeably different just because of a change in tempo is an otherwise forgettable psychedelic era Beach Boys song called Friends, which is the name of an album, which you like, but it's not for everybody. But slowed down, it was sort of revealed as a pretty interesting Burt Bacharach type of composition. Just great and interesting. It's a nice, if you like piano, and it's not a beautiful grand piano, it's kind of a clunky, whatever he's got in his sandbox these days, piano.
It's like a Fisher-Price 5 key.
It's a little
thing.
Bit nicer than that, but it also,
I don't think they're letting him near sharp objects again, are they?
It takes it away from the kind of preciousness and muzak that a piano translation exercises can be. It's a very nice record if you are like those songs.
Does he do Kokomo?
Does not do Kokomo, although by all accounts, that's one of his favorite songs to this day. That's the last
that
of the
right?
cross-examination I'm going to be allowing myself to suffer through. Join us again next Monday. Listen to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And remember, send us your emails, your webathon questions to roundtable@reason.com. Ask all kinds of questions. Just make them nice and terse so we can get through them all quickly. Thank you very much, and have a pleasant tomorrow.